I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer.
You say we don't know. We say we don't know. We say Trek the Snow.
Hello folks, and welcome to this week's episode of Trek This Out. And on this week's episode, we're going to be covering Season 1, Episode 26 of the original series, Devil in the Dark. And on this week's episode, you are joined by the A-Team.
In 1972, a crack commando unit was sent to prison by a military court for a crime they didn't commit. These men promptly escaped from a maximum security stockade to the Los Angeles underground. Today, still wanted by the government, they survive as soldiers of fortune. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you can hire the A-Team.
He's the leader of the gang, and he loves it when a plan comes together. It's Sucky as Hannibal.
Oh, hello. Right, before we carry on, I'll put you in charge of this episode, and you seem to have got the episode numbering wrong.
No, you were looking confused. It's 25 or 26, depends on how you number it.
Right, okay, carry on. I don't care now.
Okay.
Love it when I plan together.
You're doing the interrupting this time.
Oh, well, yes.
She's the popular one who all the ladies like. It's Andrea as Face.
Hello.
She ain't getting on no damn plane, and she pities a fool. It's Deb as B.A. Baracus.
Or not getting on any... I can't remember anything else he says.
Pity the fool,
that'll do.
I'm not crazy, I'm just misunderstood. It's me, Drew, as Howling Mad Murdoch. And this week, we're joined by our very own Amy Amanda Allen in the form of podcasting legend Rick Everson.
Hello, brilliant. I am that lady that joined in the last couple of series. Yay. But no one remembers.
So, Rick, you are a podcasting legend, aren't you?
Sorry a minute, Drew. Rick, can I just check something? So, you're a man and you're a podcasting legend. I'm getting quite confused here because you all look the same to me, these podcasting people. Can I call you Miles? Because I've already got one male podcasting legend in my head. I can't cope with two.
Yeah, you can. Miles is fine.
That's brilliant. Good. Because I got that last time when I was chatting to someone, I kept calling them Miles.
You just have to do it Keiko style, like Miles.
All right, that'll do. Not Nescafe then.
No, Keiko style or nothing.
Miles. Yeah, go on then, Drew.
I was going to say, back to the podcast. So, yes, Rick, you are a podcasting legend from the 10 Backwards podcast, aren't you?
I've never been described as such, but yeah, I'll go with that. So that sounds good.
So like what is your history with Star Trek then?
Oh, so when I was... about 10, 11, guy in school said to me, oh, have you seen that Star Trek The Next Generation? I was like, no. But he said it was really good, so I watched it next week, and it was The Naked Now, which might sound like the worst episode to dip your feet in with, but I loved it, got completely addicted, and from there just absolutely consumed any and all Trek solidly, daily, at all times.
Of course, it's the only thing to do with Star Trek, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So we've got a bit of, on this Star Trek podcast, a bit of Doctor Who news, haven't we?
Well, Doctor Who is starting up again just after Easter. So we are going to be doing a little recap of each episode as soon as the episodes drop, 10, 15 minutes after each episode. So please look out for that. I'm hoping that every one of the gang here will be joining in with me as we discuss each episode as they drop on a Saturday night, Saturday morning. Now, the controversy here, obviously, is there has been a lot. Well, there has been a lot of controversy where the episode is now dropping at midnight on a Friday night, Saturday morning. And there's been a bit of an uproar with certain Doctor Who fans. And they just don't like the fact that it's being dropped at that time. They think it's all to do with Disney. They want Disney to get it. Why is Disney getting it first? But they're not getting it first. The episode is dropping worldwide all at the same time. And it's just caused a bit of an uproar.
I feel like none of those people were around for the wilderness years where we didn't get anything. It's like, just shut up, we're getting stuff. Like, you don't understand what it's like for us to get nothing. I think you see it with Star Trek sometimes. People don't remember that, like, that lean, dry spell when we thought there would be never any sort of new Star Trek ever again. Just stop looking gift horses in the mouth, please. Just take what we're getting.
I think it's disgusting because it's the same day as Eurovision and we don't want to take from Eurovision. Especially since we've got our Ollie, you know, so it's already got a Russell T Davies link. Nothing should be on the same day. The whole day should be Eurovision. How dare Doctor Who take attention away from Eurovision?
How dare Eurovision take attention away from Doctor Who? You know, there's always a yin and a yang, and I do think Eurovision is taking it away from Doctor Who.
It'll be very exciting. No, I'm really excited. I will be up at midnight, I hope. And then I better have a snooze before I join the Eurovision party or in the evening. I think it's fantastic and very exciting. I like what there's loads of crap on Instagram under Russell T Davies's bit about. And I can kind of see that we have been in for a long time having to wait for American series like Star Trek to drop. This is our British series, this is ours. And now all of a sudden, to them, it feels like we're being controlled by American times. But it's not. It's being dropped onto a website. You can watch it. You can watch it whenever you like. And the fact that we are all going to get it on the same day, I think, is just a perfect launch. And think of all the people that go for pre-launch stuff anyway, in cinemas, and we've got to be very careful with the not putting stuff on social media. But I'm very excited. Oh, Stephen Moffat wrote, wait, what? Two brand new Doctor Who series on the same day? This is a whole new level of insane greatness. Speaking as a fan, I can't wait to complain about it. And I think that's
sums it up nicely.
The thing is, right, normally you'd get a Doctor episode 5 or 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock on a Saturday evening. You're not getting it like that. You're getting it 15, 16, 17 hours earlier than what you would normally get. You could watch it any time during that day. And it's still going to be shown at that time just before Eurovision, I think this week, that weekend. But it's still going to be shown just before that. I just don't see the problem. Why you got to complain about it?
And it's only the first two episodes, isn't it? The rest of it is...
No, it's still... The whole series is going to be dropping one episode a week after the initial two episodes. And then they'll all be dropping at midnight.
Really?
Yes. So it looks like your sleep pattern on a Saturday is going to be extremely different for the next few for a few weeks.
No, I'm only going to do the first for the launch because that's quite exciting. And but we're used to avoiding social media. It's fine if people want to sit and watch it as a family, because how many people do actually sit and watch television on the time that it's broadcast live? I have to admit, Christmas I fell asleep. I had to watch it late, but there are times when it's a new episode, it's nice to watch it as a, you know, lifetime, but it's very rarely.
When Doctor Who used to be shown when the kids were younger, we always used to watch it as a family. First thing, all sit around and we'd all sit there and watch it. Since all the kids are all growing up, I might have one or two of them around me, but I'll have to watch it at whatever time it drops. But this week, this time round, because it's now going to be released at midnight, I'm going to be at work anyway, so it's all going to be whenever we can get together and decide we want to watch it together. If not, I'll just watch it by myself. It's not a problem. Now, Rick, are you a Doctor Who fan?
I am a big Doctor Who fan, yes. And I'm completely not fussed about this when it drops. It's actually kind of convenient for me because I do get a lot of work shifts on Saturdays. And I want to watch it with my kids because they've got into it. We've had a massive push through all New Who recently. We got everything done in time for the specials last year. So as long as I get to watch it with them and around my work, it's brilliant. So if we have to do it on a Saturday morning, fine. If we have to do it on a Saturday, it's live, that'll be great. But I certainly wouldn't resent the rest of the world getting it at the same time. That seems a little bit weird. But...
yeah. So the other thing as well, son, as you watch your Doctor Who with your kids, now do you watch Prodigy with your kids? Because that has also dropped right now, but in French.
Yeah, it has. I do watch it. My youngest loves it. And we've now been watching a lot of Voyager because he's a big fan of Coffee Lady, as he calls her. And so we're very happy about seeing the second series. Quite excited when I saw it dropped already. So, but yeah, I thought, I'll hang on because... It's going to be no good me watching it in French.
Well, after last week's episode, I'd call a coffee lady. I'll call a salamander, mate.
Well, yeah, we haven't got to that one yet, so we might shift his names. We're not far off. It's coming soon. I can't wait to see what he makes of that one.
Captain's log, stardate 3196.1. A distress call has brought the Enterprise to Janus 6.
When that creature appears, men die.
Describe it.
I can't. I only got a glimpse of it.
Ed shot it.
A good, clean shot. Didn't even slow it down.
Captain, we are being watched.
Almost as if he'd been thrown into a vat of acid.
Strong enough to eat machinery?
Strong enough to eat anything.
That murdering monster's in there.
You're going to stay here.
So should we head back to Devil in the Dark then? So is that Schrodinger's episode number, is it? Is it number 25? Is it number 26? Not too sure. But let's start off with our initial thoughts. And should we go to Andrea? What's your initial thoughts on this?
I usually find myself sticking up for TOS on this podcast. I think that's a long sort of established tradition. And it's not going to be any different this week. I think it's up there as peak TOS, and I've got lots of positive things to say about it. So I'm going to be the shining beacon of joy this week.
Excellent. How about you, Rick? What's your initial thoughts?
Very similar. I flipping love this episode. I think it's amazing, and I could bang on about how beautiful it is for ages.
Great stuff, Debs.
It'll be boring, isn't it? I enjoyed it. There's plenty of flaws in it, naturally, because it's still early Star Trek and they're evolving their ideas. I can go more into it. Yeah, you can be very critical of it, but I enjoyed watching it. I'd be interested to know if people watch the remastered version or the original as well when we talk about it.
I did watch the remastered version, and I really enjoyed it. I don't think I've watched this episode. I've heard about it. I've seen clips about it. I've seen the whole Spock with a rock thing. This is my first time actually viewing the episode, and I've really, really did enjoy it. So, yeah, I think it's going to be very, really, really, really positive for me. How about you, Drew?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, it's classic, does not cover it in my mind. It just doesn't get much more classic than this for Star Trek, really. You know, you could cut to the chase here and just give it 5 and vote Deb off as a red shirt, and that'd be the podcast done for me.
Fantastic. Let's do that because I can watch Death in Paradise then.
I thought you'd be impressed with that.
So I did my homework a little bit because I had the feeling there was something about this episode where people had talked about it in sort of other contexts. And this is William Shatner's favourite episode of the original series, which I think says a lot, particularly as he was informed of his father's death on the set. It's one he's not forgotten, but this is Bill's favourite episode. So if it's good enough for Bill, it's going to be good enough for us.
I think that was partly because it was a bonding thing, that people were very supportive, and suddenly the whole thing meant a lot more, the people, the series.
There are scenes within the episode, just after he'd been informed about his father's death, that there's a stand in there, and unless you're actually looking, right, you don't realise there's a stand in there. The way they filmed it, I just think it was superb. I do think it's a fantastic episode for both Kirk and Spock, because both of them, there's that little relationship there, which is starting to, I mean, which has been going on for about 20-odd episodes. And then, I mean, don't know what the numbering system is, but they've been going on for 20-odd episodes. And you can see that love there between them. And there's a lot within this where people are saying this is where it all starts with the, is Kirk in love with Spock or is Spock in love with Kirk? Right, and this is where it might start. Maybe earlier than this, because I can't remember too much from the earlier, but this one is where there's a lot of stuff going on.
A lot of shipping, yes. Well, let's go to the right at the start of the episode, shall we? Because we start off with Schmitter and Vandenberg, don't we? All the miners are from New Jersey, aren't they? That's a bit weird. Yeah, yes, we are. You stay guard there. What's he guarding? It's an empty corridor, isn't it? And they've got their orange shirts, aren't they? You'd be worried if you're using one of them orange boiler suits, wouldn't you?
Yeah, no, I was right. We should vote for the orange shirts this week, not the red. Although I did think, because there are so many inconsistencies in this episode, that maybe it was that it only killed people with orange or reddish shirts, and it didn't mind pink or yellow or blue, because, you know, he didn't get time to even shoot. Yeah, whereas everybody else gets to dialogue with it. We ought to remember as well that it's a creature that lives down below. I was getting to the speech patterns of it, and so I can do my proper Kirk.
It's uncanny. Lives
deep in the planet below us, at home in solid rock.
It felt quite inevitable in those first couple of minutes when they're like, I wasn't really sure whether that guy had to stay there by himself. Like, what was he guarding? Like, it was like, yeah, you stay there, mate. Like, you know, it'd be all right.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, why not send two down there? A lot can happen in 3 minutes. It was 45 seconds, the poor bastard. They must have really hated him. Sorry, Andrew.
Yeah, but I think in terms of TOS, I'm really struggling to think of any kind of other cold opens where you're just kind of on the planet with random people. That's not something that they really did in the series. So that's a little bit of a curveball in the first few minutes, I think, for those viewers, particularly like back in the day. So I think it kind of set itself up as a bit of a different episode.
I think this is the only episode without Enterprise or any of its crew in the cold opening.
Any women.
Yes, there was a woman, but it was for a few seconds and no dialogue whatsoever. Only episode from TOS that doesn't have any women in it, yes. Rick, you had your hand up earlier.
Yes, I was going to say that maybe it's a whole different form of life, Deb. Maybe it can't see colours apart from orange.
Oh, like a bowl. Like attracted to the orange.
Yeah. There's a lot of orange on the creature. Maybe that's like... maybe it wasn't
trying to mate with the miners. Yeah,
that was just it, yeah. It was just chatting up the guys and then overdid it a bit. Didn't realise they were so combustible.
The thing that really got me, though, with these death scenes that they had for one or two of the characters is that we do actually see the creature... And that creature is basically at knee level, but for some reason, when they're all about to die, the security officers are all looking at eye level, and you're thinking, is this creature suddenly grown or shrunk, or what is it doing standing up on its hind legs? It was a bit strange with all that.
I was going to say, I have a feeling, and Rick might know the answer to this, but I think the costume came before the plot. I think, like, someone went, like, here's a costume, and someone wrote a plot around the costume. I mean, hats off to the stunt guy scuttling around with that, like, feeling that the costume was kind of, someone went, what should we do with this? And someone wrote a plot around a costume rather than the other way around.
I do know, because I have also done research. The costume was designed by Janos Prohaska, who's Hungarian.
Hold on.
Prohaska.
And he's Hungarian, and he designed it, and they told him, if you do it good, you get to play it as well. And he was a stuntman as well as an actor, and he was also the cookie bear in the Andy Williams show. And he was also, he played a gorilla in Gilligan's Island and a few other gorillas and things like that. So Rick, Miles.
Yeah, it was definitely that he designed and showed the costume, and then they wrote the episode around it. I remember reading, and it might have been in one of Shatner's memoir books, that it came about that he designed this thing and showed everyone how the movement would work. He put a raw chicken on the floor, basically, and then like made out he ate it, and then he had a chicken bones under there, and they like spat them out, and it sold the effect so well that apparently they wrote the episode fully off that idea.
Excellent. Yeah, so that's one of the things I was going to talk about, the creature. I mean, I think the creature's pretty good. It's not so good the bits when it's Kirk and the creature, I think, when you can literally see it's a guy on his hands and knees crawling around. But until that bit, I think it's a really good effect. And when they shoot the bit off and it's all pulsating, it's excellent.
It looks way better in the episode than that thing that they trot out at every destination Star Trek that just looks like a plastic pile of vomit.
Well, this is the very reason why I wanted Rick on the podcast to do this episode, because you guys always used to do every year like a brilliant little photo shot with it, didn't you? Which I've saved the pictures. I will put them in the chat at some point. I mean, it's excellent. Not so good, yeah, the one at Destination Star Trek.
I just remember the green pink. Said he saw the monster and it was big and shaggy. Maybe there were two monsters.
No, there's only supposed to be one monster. There's only one monster looking after all the eggs.
All right, so the guy in pink was just bullshitting then.
He probably just saw all the little shaggy end of the rug bits from it around the bottom as it scuttled past, because he didn't see a huge amount. I was going to say, though, in terms of what Drew said about how the monster didn't look that great, what I always love about this is one of those times that Star Trek just had the balls to go and do the most ridiculous thing ever and say, let's do something really alien. Yeah, it's a bloke under a rug, but let's go for it. Let's have something so out there. And you don't see it that much, you know, especially as you got further into the age of rubber foreheads. I think it's awesome to have something so different, so alien. And it's nice that they had the, just went for it and did that.
I also like the fact that it's a monster that you can make at home if you've got a rug and a torch. But I mean, I was deliberately thinking, I'm not going to criticise the polystyrene and the monsters, because they haven't got the same technology there. We're watching it on TV screens, which are more detailed. So it seems like the eye makeup is a bit weird that they've got on. But it was designed for television sets, which were not as good as the stuff we've got now. The problems with it, saying I enjoyed it, but things like why only stick one person when they've lost 50, they're a bit thick. And also you could tell easily what was going to happen. The whole plot was pretty obvious as soon as they came up with the silicon spherical bits.
I was just going to say, I think it's that, it's really obvious now, but I think it probably wasn't obvious at the time. I think it was that move away from, I know there's that literary tradition of the misunderstood sort of sympathetic monster, things like Frankenstein and Quasimodo and that type of thing. But I think a lot of even sci-fi television up to that point was like the big horrible monster's going to kill you. And that's probably what audiences were anticipating. So it was quite different. And I think that it was still in that era of television where it was almost like it was the teleplay, wasn't it? It was almost like film theatre in terms of the sets and in terms of the sort of the way it was framed. And but I think this is an episode that benefits from 60s TV production because everything's so bloody dark now. Can you imagine trying to watch an episode in a cave? Like, I'd be like whacking up the brightness and I still wouldn't be able to see what's happening. So I think the fact that it's quite well lit is actually a positive because I don't know why, but television's so bloody dark now. I'm like quite grateful. I wouldn't want to see a sort of current episode because it is too dark as it is.
The fact that Andrew just says it's so brightly lit. Now, of course, as Deb said as well, it was meant for televisions in the 60s. And we're watching it now with, you know, super swanky televisions and all details and everything. The one thing that really put me off is the cave sequences, is the caves itself, is the fact that you could tell that it's just a piece of cloth around some frame that's giving it out a look. And then you got the floors, which are just super smooth, and some sort of polystyrene thing just chucked on the floor. That sort of took me out a bit. But because the story is well acted and it's a really good story, you could sort of forget about that. I know years later, you've got like Lower Decks taking the piss out of you, all the cave sequences. But once you've got into the story, you can sort of forget about the caves, how smooth they look, how well built they look, how polystyrene and cloth covered they are. But, you know, it's one of them things.
I fully believe that when we get to other planets, we will dig down into caves and find the alien caves that look like that. They look like cloth and polystyrene because they're alien rocks. That's what they look like.
You've got an explanation for everything you have, don't you?
Yeah, pretty much.
So I enjoyed it, but it'll be interesting to see as well the difference between the remastered, because I just went with it and I didn't worry too much about, you know, even though you could actually see, virtually see the guy crawling underneath the blanket or the rug, wherever it is. I just went with it, but there are some changes with the remastered. I'd love to see it, but I'm not paying for Paramount Plus at the moment, and I managed to get it on the Paramount Prime or whatever, which wasn't the remastered. But it's the whole thing about the planet, Anus 6. You've got the... it's a mining community, and at the end they go, oh, look, you can live with these monsters because it's going to make you mega rich. At what stage did the future become not about greed and money? Or was that just sort of invented after this? And also, as soon as they said that strategic part that came out, that they nicked from this, that's the strategic place that just makes it not work. They had to take that bit and you think, isn't that a clue that these might just be a bit intelligent?
As you're saying about the remastered and the new TVs, and one of the things that really struck me as I watched it last night was all the dramatic close-ups, particularly early on. The miners, they've really plastered on the makeup, and you could see it, and I'm just like, you know what? Fair enough. In the future, if they're comfortable and they're embracing it and they just want to look good, but I slightly feel like I accidentally put on The Only Way Is Essex. So
it's Jersey Shore, isn't it? We said they were from New Jersey.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, yeah. But I do agree, Deb. I found it was they did miss an obvious clue there about the creature's intelligence when it took that particularly. And I also kind of, it struck me a little bit weird that why have they made all these colonies' life support reactors dependent on this one material, this one thing that they have to dig up on this one planet? That just seems like really poor planning to me. The Federation have made an error, quite frankly.
And it was asbestos.
Yeah.
In terms of fun props, though, I do feel like Scotty kind of came down and basically seemed to be fashioning a bomb. It was like, hell, but I'm like, it really looks like a bomb. Like, okay. So, yeah, I think there was some creative choices made in the props department for that one. But, yeah, it definitely looked like that's what he was knocking up.
It struck me that's a poor showing for Scotty, though, because when they called up and says, no, I ain't got anything like that. Can you rig something up? Yeah, but it won't last very long. He's like, you're supposed to be a miracle worker. You're supposed to be able to build a warp engine and stuff out of like a few odds and sods lying around. And you can't do some, when you all admit it's an old and primitive design, they'll be able to knock something up in no time.
Yeah, okay, so that's something that Scotty normally does, doesn't he? He always complains, I cannot do it. It's going to take me this amount of time. I haven't got the materials. And he always does it. And this is where he comes a cropper, where he actually admits it beforehand, thinking that he isn't going to admit it. It isn't going to happen. And then, unfortunately, it does happen. So he's still a miracle worker, but it sort of backfired this time around. So, yeah. The other thing about a monster being misunderstood, Doctor Who also did this, and I was just remembering that, is for 3 years previously in a story called Galaxy 4, where the Dravins, who are beautiful, blonde-haired, blonde women, who just decide to deceive the Doctor and say the monster-like Rills were the bad guys, when it turns out it was the Rills that were the good guys and the Dravins were the bad guys. So Doctor Who did it. It's like 2 or 3 years previously in one of their stories.
It's not fair, though, because the Doctor can time jump, can't he? So he probably, the Doctor moved, went into the future and saw Star Trek did it and then nicked the idea. There is some brilliant, I mean, I love Scotty. It's a plumber's nightmare quote. And the I'm a doctor, not, oh no, that's the that McCoy in it, yeah. And then you've got Bones, yeah, saying, yeah, I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer. But one of the best things about the monster is it can shit alpha spaghetti. I mean, that's pretty impressive for the 60s.
I was just going to pick up on that, like, quotable quotes thing. I feel like this episode's teeming with things that almost sound like they came out the Star Trek and song. I think there's something about it. It's life, but not as we know it. I think that gets chucked in there or something very close. Obviously, there's McCoy's a doctor, not a bricklayer. I think Kirk manages to utter shoot to kill. So, yeah, it's kind of littered with those almost quotes, which made me happy. And it was like almost like a little bingo card.
Should we talk about one of my favourite characters in it, Lieutenant Commander Giotto? He's a Silver Fox red shirt, isn't he? And that's got to be a rarity to get to Silver Fox stage of being a red shirt. That's no doubt why he's not only got a name, but he's got a rank, hasn't he? Well, what do we think of him?
Well, it was just that almost like they kind of brought in that like sort of lineup of red shirts. And I kind of in my notes, I put they provided it with a buffet. And then I've questioned whether or not a buffet of red shirts is like a collective noun for them. So something there.
The actor that plays Giotto, for some reason, he's, if you look at the credits, he's and Barry Russo as Lieutenant Giotto. And I don't think he appears before or after or since in them stories as that character. I know he appears as somebody else, but not that character. So why did he get such preferential treatment as in the credits at the end?
Is he the one from Little House on the Prairie or whatever it was?
I'm wondering if he was a bit of a kind of known television actor. And
Maybe. He probably was familiar to American audiences at that time. But I just, you know, passage of time, he seemed to be a bit forgotten.
Yeah, it does make me laugh that bit when all the red shirts are lined up and Kirk says, oh, the creature's on level 23. Can you all go down to level 23? You'd be like, I'm sorry, I'm not going down to level 23 in this red shirt at all, I'm afraid, Kirk. No, but the other thing is, Spock, he keeps like setting his tricorder to be able to pick up silicon life forms, doesn't he? And he keeps saying, oh, it's like it's 100 metres, like bearing 200 or whatever. See, he always does know exactly where it is, doesn't he? But they're still sending out these poor red shirts to their deaths to just have a wander around.
I feel like Spock turns up and solves the whole thing within 30 seconds, doesn't he? He picks up that, like, spray-painted child's football and goes, oh, yeah, I think I'm onto something here. He does kind of suss it pretty quickly in the episode, I think. He just kind of doesn't share with the team immediately. But then he kind of goes through the whole, like, he goes through that whole moral conscience thing, oh, it's the last of its kind, you know, it would be bad if something happened to it. And then, like, 10 minutes later, he's like, yeah, kill it. Kill it, yeah, like Jim, just kill it. And then he does his mind meld thing and he's like, oh, you know, I feel bad for it now. So he kind of goes through the mill a bit in this episode, does Spock. He kind of changes his mind on several occasions, I think.
I loved the sudden change of heart, though, because it was such a thing, because he makes such a good point. It's a really good argument. It's like, you know, to kill this is the last of its kind. It'd be a crime against science. Dramatic music and zoom in. Dun, dun. Crime against science is the worst. And then it's like, no, actually, the worst would be is something happened to Jim. And he's saying, kill it, kill it. You mustn't hurt my boyfriend. And it, yeah. So I love that because he loses his cool. He absolutely loses his cool at the idea of Kirk getting hurt. And he's like, crime against science, I don't care. So I really enjoy that for the whole Spock moment. And as you say, it's one of those things that really sets off their love.
He definitely gets emotional, doesn't he? It's a surprise. Mm-hmm. You don't see that very often from Spock, I don't think. Well, maybe every other episode. But the other people who really quickly turn on a dime are the miners at the end, aren't they? I'm just always amazed at that. Like, they've killed 50 of the miners in their orange boiler suits, and they're all like, oh, kill it, we're gonna, even if we haven't got our phases, we're gonna club it to death. And then he goes, oh, it's a mum protecting its children. And I just go, oh no, we're sorry, in that case, don't worry. It's just a real, like, dime turn of emotions, isn't it?
That scene, yeah, it does stick out as a bit of a sore thumb within the episode. But you could also look at it in another way, in that these miners are sort of immoral people that just want, they're there for the money, and that's it. So once I sort of hear what Kirk's explanation is and Spock's explanation, and then they realise they've already got their brains ticking out, well, we can use these creatures to maybe drill into the planet themselves or take it to another planet to start drilling away over there. They've already got it into their heads that we can make loads of money, especially when Kirk basically endorses the plan as well. And he just goes, yeah, no problem. We're going to be rich. Don't care about 50 people that are just done. We've already cremated them. We're already in little pots. It's done. No worries.
So I kind of had a different feeling on that turn, because I kind of felt that they'd been building the miners up as these quite threatening guys. I think there's a point where the leader introduces one of the others, and he's a really, like, grim looking bloke, and he's just like flipping it. He would be playing a villain with an expression like that normally. And then, of course, when they turn on all the guards, you're thinking, oh god, these guys are bad. But then they come in and like it's killed 50 of my men. It's like, and you've killed 5,000 of his children. And they immediately stop, and it's kind of like oh crap, we've killed a load of kids. Oh, maybe we're the bad guys here. And I quite like the sudden turn. It's like, oh, they've actually realized the error of their ways a little bit. I didn't read too much. I suppose, yeah, you can see the absolute, like, it's the money, the dollar signs in their eyes kind of thing, maybe. But I, watching it last night, it was a bit like, they realize they've had a change of heart.
Apparently in the remastered edition, there's a picture, a bit of the miners playing with the baby. It's in the background, but I don't, Suki doesn't remember it. But they must be pretty rough, because they've got a whole load of trained security guards from the Federation around them with phasers, and they managed to beat them by clubbing them over a head with... Well, go on then, Suki.
Well, that's one of the things that I think Kirk would have disciplined the miners, really, because you do actually see when they club them, there's one right at the back that's swinging a club or metal piping, whatever, and it goes whack, whack, whack three times onto one of the security guards who's on the floor, on the head. And I'm just thinking, that poor guy's head's caved in. Kirk must have a few words being said about that.
Well, the thing about that scene is, like, just before it, when Kirk's speaking to Giotto on his communicator, he says, you know, oh, what's it like there? And he says, oh, Vandenberg and his men are here, and they're all pretty ugly. Did you mean to say their mood is pretty ugly? Because you just said that all the men are ugly. No wonder they're beating them up like 5 minutes later, isn't it? But yeah, that's quite an awful scene when they're clubbing them.
Well, so, to be honest, they're not exactly lookers, are they? Not one of them. I wouldn't have taken them out on a date at all. No problem.
Just in terms of weapons, I just want to pick up on Phaser 1 and Phaser 2, because I don't think this ever gets mentioned ever again. But why have they got Phaser 1? Like, Phaser 1 seems like something they've ordered off, like, AliExpress, which doesn't really kind of do what it's meant to do, but it looks kind of right. So I don't understand why they've gone for the cheap models when you're kind of on this, like, sort of remote planet. But I have a feeling this kind of never gets brought up again. This is one of them things they've mentioned, like, oh, they've got the cheap crap ones, so they'll not work.
So I just got excited there, because I was like, okay, so Phaser 1, it plugs into the top of Phaser 2 as, like, a power thing. So if you see them, the Phaser 2, the handle and the emitter, is like, so it's all overpowered, but they literally plug together to make the more powerful Phaser 2.
Oh. I'm just looking around. I know I've got one somewhere. I've got one of each, actually. You're saying that, though, but that's not strictly speaking true, Rick. It's not Phaser 1, Phaser 2. It's Type 1 Phaser, Type 2 Phaser. It's really grinds my gears as a fully fledged Trekkie, that why are they calling them Phaser 1 and Phaser 2? Because it does come up later, Andrea, but they call them Type 1 Phaser, Type 2 Phaser. Phaser 1 and Phaser 2 sounds like films, don't they? It's like Phaser 2, like the revenge of, whoever.
The Hoarder.
Yes.
This ongoing inconsistency in TOS is why I've declared all Star Trek After the Cage to be non-canon.
Definitely.
I was just going to say, I feel like it's still a show that's trying to work out who it is and what it is. But actually, when you think how, like, what you're kind of getting towards the end of the first season, but you really, those characters are really clear. And I know they're quite archetypal at this point and they're not particularly complex, but you know what Spock's about, you know what Kirk's about, you know what McCoy's about, you know what Scotty's about. Like, we know who these people are, in a sense. So it's kind of, it is getting to that point where, like, it's kind of established itself.
Well, you think about it, it's 25, 26 episodes in. They should know how these characters are going to interact and perform, and this show's been on, like, weekly for basically 6 months of the year already, so the characters should all be well established by now, and they are, sort of. The relationship between Kirk and Spock, even though we've now sort of thought it's a romantic relationship, there's a lot of friendship there.
I think it's really disappointing, though, that mind melds get so more low-key. Like, I think they should have stayed with the full-on, like you could have really overacted this scene. Because I feel like Bill gets a lot of grief for, like, overacting scenes, but that mind meld scene was kind of... It was hard to tell, wasn't it? It was like,
So I think Marina Sirtis must have seen that for Encounter at Farpoint.
It's a rare case of Leonard Nimoy Shatnering it up, isn't it? Which, you know, you allowed one episode to do it. What my wife always says every time he lays his hands and does the second mind meld, how does he know that it's not his arse or something he's got his hands on? Which is a very good point, because, you know, it's no obvious head or anything on that creature, is there?
I'm going to assume they just went with the thing. If it's moving forward, the front bit must be the head. But yeah, there's no guarantees. That could have been, which actually was one of the things I was watching it and I was thinking, God, mind melds are so, like, troublesome in terms of consent, aren't they? And which now, if it is its rear end, you put a whole new level on as well. But but I did want to shout out to Nimoy for just going for it, and that he absolutely just, like, runs with that, and it's a thing of beauty to watch him overact like that. It's amazing.
I was just going to say, in terms of that, like, sort of mind meld, as we are reminded in Star Trek VI, not everyone keeps their genitals in the same place.
And there's also a non-consensual mind meld, isn't there? It's a pretty awful scene at the end there, isn't it? Valaris, is that her name?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I liked the mental mind meld sat-nav instructions as well. Turn left at the Chamber of Ages. Go straight on to the Vault of Tomorrow. Feel sorry for the murdered children and cry for the children. Mornington Crescent. You know, I mean, it just needed the ending. I think some of my references are for people far too older than the rest of you.
I get it.
There was also a bit, I don't know if it was mentioned, one of the classic lines is, it's not life as we know it.
Yeah, they make a big thing of it, don't they? Like, and McCoy sort of picks up Spock, I think, who says, first of all, silicone-based life forms, and saying about, oh, you know, what are you talking about? But, I mean, we've postulated silicone-based life forms, haven't we? It shouldn't really be that foreign to people in the 23rd, 24th century, really.
It shouldn't be, but it is for some reason. I've never encountered a silicon base. They're never going to, as you say, postulate whether they exist or not. Right. So, yeah, they probably haven't come across anything like that in the past.
I actually found that a bit disappointing for McCoy, because he was so just like, oh, Spock, you're like living in a fantasy world, silicon life. I was like, well, fair enough if you haven't encountered it, but, you know, you're a doctor on the Enterprise. You have seen some weird shit. So I find it very sort of narrow-minded of you to just dismiss this possibility out of hand. So in the old episode, that was probably one of my little niggle bits that McCoy was a bit like, just have a pop at Spock. He was going to be really narrow-minded about a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I absolutely love McCoy, but he's through the whole of the episode, isn't he? Like when Kirk says about, oh, come and heal it, and he's just like, nope, I ain't got anything to do with that. I cannot do it. I mean, he successfully does it in the end, doesn't he? Was it the thermal concrete or whatever?
Yeah, but there's a bit as well that Spock goes in and picks up the egg, or was it the silicon nodule? And he realises, and he goes, like, he basically gets laughed at, going, yeah. And McCoy goes, yeah, sure, right, okay, you know, silicon life or something like that. So he says, yes, I do have an idea, but I don't want to be laughed at again. And you think, poor bless little Spock, you know, that he could have solved it in 5 minutes if he hadn't been bullied in that way. Poor sensitive soul. I thought they were supposed to be non-emotional. You should have just twatted him. Sorry, no, that would have been emotion.
There's a couple of times where Spock has sort of backed down. I mean, and he hasn't communicated. I mean, as you says, there's that bit there where he doesn't want to carry on with that conversation. And the other one is, Drew said earlier, was the tricorder. He's got the tricorder. Why isn't he just given this information and told all the security detail? Make sure your tricorders are all switched on, and make sure you have this information programmed into it. You can exactly where this creature is going to be, so you're never going to be in any danger as such, because you can always call your backups to wherever the location is of this creature, and you can just deal with it that way. But no, Spock may have been bullied and decided to keep all that information to himself, and then decides to work it all out with everybody else, and then tells everybody. But now,
I think this episode and those points demonstrate that Spock claims to work on logic, but is in fact just a massive drama queen. So he's not going to say it. And you know what? I'm going to withhold information until the most dramatic time to reveal it. This is all going to be a big adventure. And we could have solved it in 5 minutes. But nope.
Or unless you hurt my Kirk. And if my Kirk's in danger.
Yeah. But I'm going to hold on to this knowledge until I look the cleverest near the end.
The end of the episode is, you were saying about the, you know, they're slagging off Spock, but that's what TOS is all about, isn't it? It's like, how many digs can they get in at Spock? And the end, like, when they end on the joke about the Horter liked his Vulcan ears, and what does Kirk say about, I suspect you're becoming more and more human all the time. And Spock says, I see no reason to stand here and be insulted. But that's quite an emotional thing to say, isn't it? Really taking insult at that.
I really love that, like, end of episode, almost like a sitcom ending, isn't it? And they have that little, like, that little musical jingle that sort of cues who he is, a little bit of hijinks. Like, I love that. Like, that whole, like, I always look forward to that little bit at the end of the Office episode just to see what the little, like, kind of in-joke's going to be.
Is it an in-joke at the expense of Spock normally, isn't it, for TOS, unfortunately? Some bit of racism or something from McCoy?
One day, near the end of TOS, Spock's going to write a lengthy email to HR and get them all in trouble because they are horrible to him.
So Spock does say that the Horta are quite logical, doesn't he? So he gets on with them very well. The other good quote from McCoy, which just comes over, is his country doctor, that is, "By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day." Oh, what an excellent quote is that.
As he stands there with the cement all in his hand, just dripping onto the floor, and he's like, "Oh, I can cure a rainy day, yes."
I was just going to say that it's a good job there's a branch of B&Q on the Enterprise so they could get all that cement.
Well, he does say, doesn't he, that it's used for shelters or something, doesn't he?
Yeah, they had cement on board. They didn't have any pumps for reactors. Weird oversight.
We have mentioned that during this, William Shatner's father died during the production. Now, there was a scene which was apparently shot just soon after he found out, which was the one where the young security officer is killed and Kirk kneels down and looks in agony, basically. And this was supposed to be just soon after he'd found out about his father. And I think that's maybe not acting. It might just have been all real life just coming through.
The only thing is, I'm really curious how Spock came to those odds. Like, they were really long odds. And it's like, based on what? Because this thing that nobody can attack is indiscriminately killing people in these tunnels. Like, why are those odds so long? Like, really? Like, I don't know. Like, I would like him to, like, calculate odds, like, in horse racing and give us a tip, because I think that would be a very good thing. So they did seem excessively long odds, I think, based on, like, the situation they were in.
2,228.7 to 1.
That's exactly what I was just about to say. Yeah, I wrote that down as well, because I always think that they love doing these odds in Star Trek. Like, Dax does them a few times, and she does it in the Trials and Tribulations at the same time and comes up with the exact same number that Spock does. There's no way you get any scientist would know. There's too many variables. There's no way you can calculate something that precise.
A, future scientists can, and B, I particularly like Kirk's reaction to the 0.7 bit, because that kind of, at that point, the tension in their discussion just goes and they just start flirting about the 0.7, and it's beautiful.
Definitely. I mean, talking of which, if we're going to bring some maths into the podcast, which I'm always up for. So I did actually look up, because when Spock's holding them silicon nodules, I think someone said they look a bit like painted children's inflatable balls. I mean, it's the density of silicon, 2.33 grams per centimeter cubed. I reckon that's about a 15 centimeter radius on that, 4/3 pi r cubed. That would have been about 30 pounds, them silicon nodules, weren't they? There's no way you can pick one up with one hand. It's just me, though, notice that one.
I did notice that it was very light for a rock of any kind, as they kept referring to them as a rock, but also, like, it was definitely, like, it wasn't even like a proper football. It was like what I would describe as a penny floater, which is a really, really cheap, really, really light kind of the worst kind of football you can possibly get your hands on. So yeah, it did seem very flimsy. And also they kind of, I know they were meant to be the eggs, but they seemed to crack really easily as well. It was like, yeah, it's kind of like a bit of an Easter scene. Yeah, like, oh, they managed to just, like, crack through them. They're very flimsy.
The eggs are very flimsy, and you see the broken shells, but you don't actually see any contents. So where is the actual creatures that were in, supposed to be, you know, inside these eggs, gestating in these eggs? There's nothing there. So it just seems, I mean, if one of them had been broken and they had been smashing them up, and they saw these, whatever was in there, maybe these miners would have thought differently and decided to analyse these a bit more thoroughly rather than just dismissing it as just of no value at all.
How many lights you see?
Four lights!
I asked how many lights you see.
Okay, then. So if we've discussed that episode at length, shall we move on to our lights out of five? And who should we start with? Should we start with you, Sucky? What's your rating of this episode?
You know, Summer, I can't remember watching this episode in its initial run. And I, as I says, I've just seen the odd clip here and there and photos. But watching it again, watching it this time, I think it's a really fantastic episode. And it, the Kirk-Spock relationship is brilliant in it. The dilemma of whether it's a monster or not is great. The tension that builds up with some of the other stuff happening within this episode is fantastic. So I'm actually going to give this a 5 out of 5 lights because I just think it's a fantastic episode.
Excellent stuff. How about you, Deb? Your expression on your face is kind of saying that it's not going to get a 5.
No, I enjoyed it, but no, not 5. I don't know. He's not been well, though, Suki, bless him. No, I'm going to go 3 silicon nodules out of 5.
What about you, Rick? What's your thoughts on the ratings for this episode?
I adore this episode. Always have done. I remember vividly both the original and the... And I watched the remastered. I just think everything is... It's like Trek in its purest form, I think, this episode. It has the monster. It has the working around. It's unknown life. And rather than... Although it's a direct threat, we work through the idea of killing it and then actually make contact and embrace it and, you know, work together with it by the end. We have the Kirk-Spock relation. Everything about it just works and is awesome to see. So I am also going to go with 5 out of 5 on that one.
Super. Andrea?
I really like it. I think it's a really, really, really sort of classic episode of TOS. It's what I want in a sort of original series episode. But when I think about kind of my favourite episodes, I would definitely give a 5 to something like Balance of Terror. I don't love it quite as much, so I'm going to give it 4.5.
Okay, well, myself, like I said at the beginning, this is 100% a 5 for me. I just think if you was going to show someone an episode of TOS, I mean, this would be one of the contenders, surely. Because like you said, Rick, it's just got the excellent Spock and Kirk. It's got the, although it's a bit signposted for modern day audience, it's got the turnaround of the monster turns out to be the goodie and the miners were the baddies. Yeah, I just think it's as classic Trek you can get.
You've got nothing about the positivity of humankind because, you know, maybe I'm expecting too much from early Trek, but, you know, the only reason they embrace the horrid porter is because they can make money out of it, really. So
it's a very good point. I do always think, oh, I hope no one invented the replicator too soon after this and like all money become obsolete, because what happened to the relationship then?
It's still very much the negativeness of and the cruelty of humankind, but it is the first series of Star Trek, so maybe I'm being unfair.
But the thing is, regardless of the sort of the financial implication, people still needed those resources, didn't they?
I think that because they're saying, you know, that in the future society, humankind doesn't need money, and it's, but you know, how do you actually incentivize people to do pretty crappy jobs like that? Well, I assume it's not a job which is good fun, particularly if 50 of your colleagues get, burnt to a crisp or seared to a crisp. He wasn't good on his allegory, you know, really, was he? He liked his crisps.
Don't we all? It's definitely got the kind of American 60s thing about it, about, yes, the dollar wins out in the end.
But why didn't they get Uhura? I mean, they're trying to communicate with a new creature, and they don't even go, oh, Uhura, you've got an idea on this. It's straight in with the mind meld of something which, how do they know it wasn't hot? It's been burning people and creating crisps.
The bit about you bringing Uhura in, they haven't actually got any vocal cords, so how's the halter and Uhura supposed to communicate? The only way they seem to be able to communicate is through telepathic means.
The alpha spaghetti.
Yeah, but initially they needed the mind meld for the halter to be able to learn the language, to be able to do the alphabet spaghetti.
If you've ever read any of the continuation novels of TOS, you do end up with a Horta crew member on the Enterprise. I can't remember how they explain how it talks in that, though.
There's a similar creature, but it has got a voice and a mouth and everything, which is on the Orville, which is like an oozing blob. Yeah. Right, so there is means and ways, but you do need to give it a vocal cord to be able to communicate with the rest of the crew.
Is it Yavitz, is it?
Yavitz, yeah, that's it.
Yeah. Shit Scrabble tiles.
I like the idea that the Horta just continues to burn its messages into the floor as it wanders around the deck. It's like just suddenly burns into that fancy hitting 10 forward for a drink tonight.
Get me a cup of tea.
With the carpet.
All those little maintenance robots are like going around having to repair them constantly, going for fucking water.
There must be just loads of like potholes all over the place.
Yeah, imagine it taking a shortcut to its sleeping quarters, straight through.
Don't need turbo lifts.
So that's what we thought of the episode, but what did everyone else think of it? Time for some listener feedback. So the first one we got is from Dave K, and this is what Dave K has to say about the episode. Hello, I hope you have more feedback this week. Yes, that wasn't great feedback last week, obviously, from Threshold. Devil in the Dark. I first saw this when a local commercial station repeated all of Classic Trek in the late 90s and had good memories, but watched it again today for the podcast. I think this is a very solid episode of 60s Trek. I love episodes where humanity is out on the edge, setting up colonies and exploring space. I love that we're so early in Trek that Silicon Life is a new concept for the show and for the Federation. The tension in the first half builds up well and mostly holds it in the second half. A lot of really neat concepts that might be a little cliched and obvious today, but wouldn't have been at the time. Lots of points I could discuss, but I'm sure you'll cover them all as you always do. 3.7 lights. Not a classic, but solid. Thanks for that feedback, Dave.
Can we recognise the fact with a gold star for mathematics or something for Dave K, because he's consistently giving in feedback, even through the agony of having to watch last week's. So thank you, Dave K.
It's from Jack McMorrow, meant to start that with Star Trek Devil in the Dark. Star Trek as a franchise doesn't really do Monster of the Week, and when they do, results aren't exactly stellar. See Armus in TNG's Skin of Evil for a very good example. Additionally, this is an incredibly early into a now 57-year-long, 900-episode and 13-film franchise. Should I expect them to not even have a handle on how regular tropes and characters? The not that deep subtext of an unspoken love between Kirk and Spock is very prominent to see to me. Maybe that's because I'm watching with more 2024 eyes. The show is broadcast extremely soon after England won the World Cup at Wembley. That context is brilliant to me. I don't watch TOS or TAS as much as in everything from TNG onwards, including DS9. Why would I say that? But I think this episode stands with the Trouble of Tribbles and Mock Time and City on the Edge of Forever. Head, shoulders, knees and toes, ahead of Spock's brain and its ilk. In conclusion, I didn't expect to enjoy this episode at all. I've seen it before, but my last viewing was probably in the 1990s on BBC Two on Sunday. I really enjoyed it this time around. I give this 4 Hawter Eggs out of 5. Just for Paramount Plus, the DVD years ago let me watch the show in both remastered and original format. I can't do that 15 years later on Paramount Plus. That'd be really cool.
Splendid stuff.
So I've got Murray Christensen, who says, "Hi, everyone. Devil in the Dark. For starters, this gets points for the pulpy SF name. I really like this episode. Yes, the tunnels of the mining colony don't stand up under the unforgiving scrutiny of modern HD television, and the Hawter itself is basically an angry rogue. But the story at the core is solid. What initially seems to be standard crew versus a monster story, we get the interesting twist that the Hawter is intelligent and merely defending its brood. These days, I have a lot more time for a story which ends up with everyone sorting out their differences and learning to live together, which was unusual then and is still unusual now. Overall, an episode well regarded as a classic. Even with the dodgy monster, this one's 5 lights from me."
Title: Devil in the Dark, Peace and Long Life. In this fan favourite classic episode, the crew of the USS Enterprise responds to a desperate plea from a mining colony. Profits are down. Miners are being killed by a mysterious creature that tunnels through the mines. As Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock and a security team investigate, they discover the creature known as the Hawter is not inherently hostile, but rather misunderstood. What makes Devil in the Dark stand out for me are its powerful themes and character moments. So, tolerance of all life forms. The encounter with the Hawter exemplifies one of the Star Trek's core values, tolerance and respect for all forms of life. Instead of immediately seeking to destroy the unknown, the crew communicates with the Hawter, seeking understanding. Naturally, they forget about silicon-based life forms by the time Home Soil, TNG, comes around. The search for intelligence. The episode reminds us to look for intelligence and meaning in unlikely places. The Hawter, initially perceived as a monster, turns out to be an intelligent and misunderstood being. Action and suspense. As an action show, Devil in the Dark delivers suspense and excitement. Excellent cold opening on the planet rather than the Enterprise. The tension builds as Kirk and Spock track the Hawter through the dark tunnels. Excellent telepathic and mind meld moments from Mr. Spock. Devil in the Dark was written by Gene L. Coon, one of the main stalwarts of Trek, Dorothy D.C. Fontana being the other. The episode marks the first appearance of Dr. McCoy's catchphrase, "I'm a doctor, not a ... The heart of this episode lies in its message. It embodies the hopefulness and anti-cynical nature for which Star Trek is renowned. An excellent piece of negotiation with Captain Kirk too. So let's give Devil in the Dark the credit it deserves and appreciate its enduring themes. Also, re-silicon lifeform, amnesia, Wesley's nanites, and sort of, and also the exocomps, sort of. Are the Hawter distant Doctor Who cousins of Eldred? Who must live, apparently. Cheers, Davey Paul. Live long and prosper."
The Andred is a story from Tom Baker's era. It's
And a Fear, isn't it?
And a Fear. Sarah Jane's last story. Kat, and Kat says, "The Devil in the Dark is one of my favourite TOS episodes. We have a frightening creature that can burn humans to a cinder. What's the first plan? Of course, kill it. It's interfering with Pygmalion mining operations. Fortunately, Spock gets a special understanding of the creature and her reason for doing murder and passes this on to Kirk Etzel. What is special about this episode is it's one of the first to show us Spock translating the thoughts of an alien for us. The meld shows us how pained Mother Hawter is, not only by her wound, but by the deaths of thousands of her children. The episode teaches us compassion for those we don't understand so well. That what is terribly frightening and alien can eventually be understood. And that there can be great benefits to understanding each other. Like the freedom to follow little baby Hawters around through the tunnels and just take home all the precious minerals you could ever want. Maybe they'll even find Prime Lorca. Cheers for that, Kat." We finally got our last piece of feedback, which is Alison McCrady, and They say, no kill eye, social commentary on the start of greater involvement in the Vietnam War. Thank you very much for that. That's all our feedback.
Splendid. So after all the feedback, it's now time for us to vote off our red shirt, or is it orange boiler suit of the week?
I woke up this morning, put on my red shirt.
So no, who's
so
should...
I. No,
so
I.
No, can I.
So who should we start with? Should we go with you, Sucky? Who's your orange boiler suit miner from New Jersey of the week?
Right, so I've got a list, right, of people. Now, first of all, I've got Drew down here for not letting me do a long piece of feedback. He immediately gave it to Huawei to Deb. I had to do a small piece of feedback. It was just terrible. And now I've got for Deb for doing the long piece. You could have just turned around and said, no, I don't want to do a long piece. I want to do the small piece. I could have done that long piece then. Rick, you didn't want to host the episode. So I've had Drew all day going, I've got to do the hosting. I've got to write all this stuff down. I've got to do this and the other. And I've had him crying on my shoulder. The poor bloke. It's just terrible. I don't know how you managed to put that poor bloke through you. And obviously, I've just gone for Andrea. So Andrea has to be my red shirt because I've got reasons to wear a red shirt everybody else. And Andrea, I've got no reason. So Andrea is my orange shirt of the week. Sorry, Bob.
Oh, Andrea, do you want to retaliate with your orange boiler suit New Jersey miner of the week?
Do you know what? I feel like my mind's been blown here because actually, like, we always think of a reason for someone to be there, but actually, like, red shirts are, like, it's completely, like, a pointless and meaningless death, isn't it? It's just, like, you're literally there as, like, fodder. Like, there's no reason red shirts get killed. So I feel like my whole, like, worldview has been shook by that. So I'm going to have to nominate Sookie because I don't know how I'm going to reconcile my entire view of red shirting. No, I feel like it's been destroyed, so...
We have had people just nominate because they can't think of anything else to nominate in the past. Though this is, you know, I'm just following a trend that we've always had, a tradition.
Okay, well, let's go to you, Rick, next. Who do you want to who would you like to be dissolved by acid by a Horta?
I am sorry to say I can only nominate Deb because that rating for Devil in the Dark is what Spock would term as a crime against science.
Was expecting that I would be out.
Okay, Deb, do you want to get your revenge back on Rick or someone else in mind? Who's your vote?
To be fair, I was intending to go 3.5, but that's not going to help, is it, in the circumstances? I was very undecided until the last minute, but after all that whinging, it's got to be Sookie.
Okay, well, I am unsurprisingly maybe not also going to go for Sookie for accusing me of not being completely prepared to just host an episode at the drop of a hat. Have you not seen how much notes I've got in this book? I could do the next 10 if you want. Thank you very much.
I'm just going to let the listeners in on a little behind the scenes detail. He has been on my case all day today saying, I can't do it. I can't do it. I don't want to do it. I don't want to. And I've turned around and said, you've put your foot down. I put my foot down. I said, just get on with it, man. To joke. He's always prepared. He's always prepared.
I saw it in live action as you typed back. Sookie said, Rick doesn't want to host. Does anybody want to volunteer? And at that moment, Drew said, I don't mind. And I said, that's good. I typed.
Did you? Really?
Yes.
Dog around deleting these messages because I'm going to go back and have a look at them.
You're a cruel tyrant, Sookie. I'm glad this is coming out live on air so all the listeners can hear what the real Sookie's like.
I am not a cruel tyrant, please. You know, I am a very, very mellow tyrant. All right, that's all I am, mellow. Anyway, I have got the three votes. Am I being
four
killed
votes.
Off by three? Andrea got one vote.
Oh, sorry.
Deb got one.
I'm
I've
not
got
very
three.
Good at maths.
So... I've got three votes, so let me have it. How am I going to be disposed of? Is it going to be the Horta?
Yeah, it's going to be turned into a Walker's packet of curry-flavoured crisps with alpha spaghetti. It's got to involve crisps. That man does seem to be rather obsessed with crisps.
Burnt to a crisp, but there
burnt
we go.
To a crisp. Thank you,
Andrea
very much.
Doesn't look impressed.
She's watching the clock.
No, I'm just I'm getting ready for me Spock just to try and communicate with the wounded creature, like pain, pain. Like, oh, he's suffering.
Cry for the crisp packets.
Okay, so that was Trek This Out podcast, and we was reviewing season one. It's maybe episode 25 or 26 of TOS Devil in the Dark. Thanks for listening, everyone. And just remains to say goodbye.
Bye.
Lighters.
But yeah, I was going to say something else, but I can't be asked. I can't remember what it was. It must have been very dull. Andrea.
Thank you for listening. And you can find us all on Twitter as a group. You can find us on at TrekThisOutPod. Or you can go to our Facebook page at TrekThisOut. Just Google that. You can find me on Twitter as SideMat_151.
So you can find me on Twitter as at Vintage1983V if you're into Star Trek shitposting and a lot of other thirst. If you particularly like to follow me Star Trek art, have a look on Instagram for Vin of the Basement.
And I'm just Lufdee, L-U-F-F-D-E-E, on Twitter. But if you are interested in knowing our obsession about Jason Isaacs, you can find me, Kat, and Andrea posting weird stuff about Jason Isaacs. Hashtag Team Basement.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram as 23BDI.